You're listening to Conversations with John Anderson, featuring Kim Beazley.
Kim, thanks for participating in this conversation for the series.
Good to see you again, John.
And you. I'd like to go back to towards the end of 07. We left the Parliament at the same time. And your valedictory speech. And in that, you talked about duty and service, your commitment to it. And you made a very interesting remark to the effect that you are ending that tour of duty and looking for new tours of duty. That deep sense of wanting to make a difference, where does it come from?
Well, I think it's actually inherent in an awful lot of us in politics of the era that you and I served in. Why do you do it? Well, you do it because you have a view about your country and your community, and you think that direction needs to be managed, that people need to be to make personal sacrifices to ensure that it is, and that the public life is just about the most honourable profession you can engage in, no matter what people might think. I've always had a concern about Australian survival. I mean, if you look at the various commitments I've had in political life, an awful lot of it revolves around our national defence. And the sense that I have that survival is a close-run thing for Australia. And that is survival on many fronts. The quality of our community is part of that. Our education system is part of that. Our family life is part of that. But also the physical defence of our approaches is part of that. And you think about your kids. You think about your grandkids. You think about everybody else's kids. You think about your friends, and you think what we've got here is a society worth preserving and worth improving, and that if you find yourself lucky enough to be able to seriously engage with it, and most won't, all of us need that service attitude, but most won't get to serve, you have the advantage of actually having got there, then you must continue.
Well, Kim, I just simply couldn't agree with you more. If I had my way, every Australian would have, and perhaps they will, the opportunity to hear what you've just said. And my immediate response would be to say, I think most Australians would think that's terrific. That's what we want to hear. And we're worried about our future. But we live in an age that's very different to the one that you and I are involved in just a little over a decade ago, in that trust has broken down. So you've got this massive distrust in the system. They don't trust the politicians, they don't trust the parliaments, the ANU's work shows trust is running at record levels, distrust at record levels. And of course it applies to a lot of our institutions as well. How do we restore trust? Because perhaps the first question is, can we dig our way out of our current woes without a restoration of trust? And out of that, how do we rebuild it?
Look, no, you can't. But the question is exactly the question you asked. How do you rebuild it? I think you first have to understand reasons why it might have gone. I mean, some of these things are not necessarily related to the personalities, but to the circumstances. We now live in an age, and I was just on the cusp of it and left before it really dug in, of the atomisation, if you like, of propaganda in the political system. And the way in which social media operates is to totally undermine the dignity, the validity of many of the institutions and many of the relationships which have previously served to strengthen community. I mean, the advent of cyberbullying, the advent of instant opinion that is harshly judgmental of people who are trying their best and trying to do things. It's sort of, in many ways, shattered the confidence of politicians and shattered the confidence of leadership. Well, over time, we'll get to grips with that. I do think people of goodwill will be able to, and at least counter the impact of massive social undermining. Now, some of that trust is that is a product of, if you like, our own unenforced errors as a community. Then other people are trying to reinforce those errors externally to us and exploit the divisions in our system and the like. We haven't experienced that very much in Australia, but they have massively in the UK and the United States, and those are our reference countries. Still, in many ways, the US and the UK are our reference countries. So you have that. You also, I think, have, and maybe it's a part of product of that, is enormous difficulties in being prepared to lead amongst our political parties and political leadership. You know, one of the great things about living in a democracy, and we're still democracies, is actually it doesn't matter if you lose. You're not going to go to jail. Your kids aren't going to be put in concentration camps. You will probably live reasonable lives, and you'll certainly live with the opportunity for a comeback. In those circumstances, you can afford to chance your arm. I mean, leading in a dictatorship and a ruthless and brutal oppressive one at that is a different matter altogether. We don't have those excuses, though. Our leadership is not going to have bad things happen to them as a result of their defeat. Psychologically, they'll be impacted, but in no other way. And we do need to, I think, have that willingness, again, to chance your arm when you think something's right and to argue your case. I think a further thing on trust is a breakdown in civility between people who are actually engaged in politics. That I can't remember whoever said it to me first. He also had a cynical coda on it. He said, those people in front of you when you stand up in Parliament, they're your opponents. They're not your enemies. Now, if the quote stopped there, it would be a magnificent quote because it is true.
Yeah.
The people across the chamber from you are not your enemies.
They're your opponents. They're actually your fellow Australians.
That's right. And then he says, the enemies are behind you.
Yeah.
that's the second part of that quote, which of course has its own resonance and its own essential truth.
The first person who said that to me was actually Ian Sinclair.
Oh, was it?
Yeah, I pointed at you blokes on the other side.
Well, I liked him. I remember participating at an event that the National Party put on, and they invited me to speak at. And it was an event which I'd been told privately was to encourage Ian to step down and to move on. And because they'd noticed I had a good relationship with him, they asked me to participate. So I got a funny portrait together of it wasn't a portrait, it was a picture of a Japanese heavy cruiser which had just been bombed and raked over. And I said, symbol of Ian Sinclair for his opponents in the Labor Party. And but at the end of it, he got up and said, I was thinking of going, but you obviously so like me, I'll continue to stay and be in it. But the, I think there was a... there was at least in the times that I was in Parliament a degree of mutual respect. A lot of hostility in Question Time, a lot of that was there. But there's also a lot at stake because there's a real drive intellectually for what we thought were necessary for our survival. Part of that in my lifetime extended from the experience of Bob Hawke, who was a very effective Prime Minister, and his driving force was a sense that the country had run out of steam, that without serious reform we would never be internationally competitive.
The Lee Kuan Yew line, poor white trash of Asia.
You would never be able to sustain the sort of standard of living that people wanted. Now, things moved away from that, but we're still pretty good, and sometimes you don't appreciate what you have. One of the problems in the United States is that for the last 40 years, the white middle class, they call themselves, or we'd say working class, has not actually had a real wage rise. In Australia, in that period of time, after the reforms of the 80s, the income of the average Australian has increased 2.5-fold. There actually has been a substantial benefit from the reforms.
It wasn't just the 80s,
period.
It went through the 90s.
Yeah,
and
90s,
even
yeah.
The noughties.
But that's right. But it, yeah. The impact
that's right.
of that...
Real wages did rise.
And that's right.
They flatlined for 40 to 50 years in America, while asset prices have gone through the roof, and household and public sector debt's gone through the roof.
And now,
that's a dangerous thing, that.
Yeah.
Very dangerous. Squeeze the middle class out.
And we have... And one of the difficulties in politics today that is sort of beginning to undermine the trust, not as bad as it's been in the US, but beginning to, is we actually haven't had real wage rises for about 5 or 6 years now.
I think that's a real threat to the future. I think our children and grandchildren will be very angry with us, because right across the Western world you've had economic policies designed to promote inflation. They've kept going because inflation hasn't happened, but it has. It's in asset prices. So when you and I left school, an average Australian house cost about four or five times average annual earnings. Now it's 11, or if you're in Sydney or Melbourne, 13.
Yeah, kids can't own homes anymore. So if you're really going to collapse trust, you deprive young families of a chance to have that life that they were brought up with.
Two things out of your comments there that I'd just like to tease out. One, social media. Now, Neil Ferguson, the economic historian, who is Scottish, then Oxford, then Harvard, now Stanford, has written a book about this. He actually thinks that social media may prove so destabilising, and he worries so much about the way in which the levels of hostility and hatred from the keyboard warriors bubbles away, that if it ever surfaces — it's doing enough damage now — if it surfaces, it could result in serious destabilisation. I guess there's a couple of questions out of that. One is, I think it requires enormous courage to stand in the face of social media campaigns if you're going to serve in a public position. The second is, I don't think we've come to grips with how to manage it and regulate it as societies. We've got all this machinery in place now to stop hate speech and tell people what they can and can't say, and yet we've got people who literally commit suicide after social media campaigns, and no one seems to know what to do about it.
People are trying. You know, there's a the pressure is on the people who do the service, and that pressure is beginning to work. It's efforts to stand down hate speech are actually occurring, and it is possible with the technology to chase down purveyors of hatred, and it is possible to turn them off the sort of websites that they must massively use to spread the messages that they do. There's always issues there, of course. Issues of free speech come into it. But it is the case, I think, that many of the societies are now starting to move to deal with it. I think, ironically, what's a force driving this is not so much the hatred that is being expressed by the people, you know, sitting in their own bedrooms typing it in. It's actually the exploitation of it by external factors and external forces. I mean, undoubtedly, in the United States now, an awful lot of this is being driven by the experience of being trolled by Russians, and the possibilities that other people might do this. So the paradoxical effect of that has been that what the Russians have been doing is to start to develop a counter to it, and it's a difficult thing to argue against if you actually happen to be in the domestic debate, and are now finding yourself scooped up along with the with measures that are being put in place to deal with that.
Well, it's an important subject because it does appear to have enormous capacity for destabilisation, and perhaps it's like the printing press. Ultimately, it'll turn out to be great for democracy and for human progress, but you'd have to say at the moment it is, I think, as you say, exacerbating the problem. Particularly when extremes start hurling abuse at the middle, if you can put it that way, the reasonable middle. And the reasonable middle are people who want to retreat when they meet that sort of barrage.
True. But the starting point really is, isn't it? It's what we put into ourselves, what our families put into us, what our schools put into us. It's a discussion that we have. And the starting point is the family and the school. And what do we ask of our teachers? What do we ask of ourselves in terms of what we encourage our young people to think? The apple does not fall far from the tree. And if what you're talking about is of a character and quality that means that the kids pick it up and at least internalise some of it, then that in itself is a countermeasure. You know, what values you teach at home, and teachers teach about bullying, about respect, about respect for the other gender, about, respect for people's backgrounds, ethnicity, and the rest of it. What you teach about that will not fall on fallow ground. Maybe rejected, but at least will be there in the mind. And what you teach is acceptable in discourse. That's there too. So one of the things you can't run away from, in the same way as you can't in politics run away from the responsibility you have for your society as a whole, you can't as an individual. You're not an island, is run away from the responsibility you have for the community.
David Brooks wrote in January this year in the New York Times that he thinks we have a problem with atomisation in our society. The pursuit of narcissism over 60 years, look after number one, it's all about you, has produced a society where it's hard to find consensus on the core things that matter. And that worries me about Australia, because we do seem to focus too much on the things that divide us, when there's an extraordinary number of domestic issues, as well as international issues, which need to be resolved for all Australians, regardless of who you are.
Having spent 6 years in the States, I think we're better placed than they are. You know, one of the things that I used to say, I had various sayings that you'd have at the differences between Australians and Americans. For Americans, the leitmotif is freedom.
Yep.
For Australians, the leitmotif is fairness.
Yes.
And freedom in the United States has many different aspects to it. In many ways, they're more family-oriented than we are. They're more attuned to moral debate than we are. They've got a lower divorce rate than we have. They've got greater religious participation rate. All these sorts of things.
A bit different to the Hollywood portrayal.
Yeah, very different. The US is not Hollywood, not by any shape or form, in any shape or form. But having said that, the interplay of that with the concept of freedom, which means that, and because in their society, the experience of the average American citizen is to struggle with anonymity. There are a lot of them. It is very hard to get the sort of ego-satisfying prominence in the United States. And you don't get there by being a shrinking violet. So while they've got all these counter elements to the, if you like, the divisive character of the sort of atomizing narcissism that you talk about, there still is that struggle against anonymity, which helps to drive that atomizing narcissism. Here in Australia, we tend to value the collective much more. We tend to think that that all of us have the right to be risen, as opposed to the right to rise. There's more of a sense here that part of the job of government is to sustain levels of equity in the community. They don't have that concept in the United States, not at all. But here, there is a sense that part of the role of government doesn't actually... Now, you'll often hear conservatives in Australia and conservative political parties argue against that. But when they're in office, that's exactly how they behave. Mm. Whether they like it or not, they do. Mm. It's a default position, fairness. Everybody gets forced back to it.
Embodied in the old term of mateship. Not used quite so much now, but still very deep in our psyche.
Very deep.
Very interesting, isn't it, that for the Americans, it seems to me there's a great battle going on in America between the sort of traditional 1776 model of independence and resilience on the part of the individualism, their right to do what they like, short of it turning into license, and a sort of a much more restrictive view that the government will have much greater say over your life. That seems to be something of the clash in America.
It's there. Yeah, no doubt about that. And there's again a difference in attitude there between Australia and the United States. The Americans really do struggle with the intrusiveness of the protective systems on freedom of speech and the like that come with the counter-terrorist legislation, the Patriot Act, and that sort of thing. And there is a real objection to having the government interfere with your privacy, but almost no concern about private interference with your privacy in the American system. Again, we're the exact opposite to that. Mm. You know, in Australia, the attitude is, well, if the government is interested in you, perhaps we should be too. But when it comes to the invasion of our privacy by the bankers or somebody else, we are mortally offended. And so there's that's a sort of another difference between the two cultures. These are subtle differences, but the differences are real.
So just to tease out this issue, I think it's a very important one, that their concept of freedom, you know, the thing they bang on about all the time, fairness has been the great Australian thing.
Yeah.
It seems to me there's a something of a danger if you convert fairness, which I think is a brilliant way to try and organise your collective life. Mm. We want equality of opportunity. But if you pursue equality of outcome, you can end up sacrificing freedom and fairness.
Yeah.
And there's a very important argument to be had in there, I think.
You know, and that's one of the difficulties. Equality of opportunity is, I guess, the leitmotif of the social democratic wing of the Labor Party. And as introduced by Gough Whitlam, it was equality of opportunity was his main sub-theme. But then equality of opportunity inevitably gets measured. And when it gets measured, inequality of outcome looks bad.
Yeah.
And in that you'll often find, I think, the essential difference in Australian politics between the conservative side or the right side and the left side. The left gets seriously disturbed by evidence of a lack of equality of outcome. And the other side, the conservative side, tends to be less worried by that. Yeah, they'll accept the idea of equality of opportunity. A darn hard thing to argue against when you sit down and think about
it. Very hard to argue against. Hard to secure.
Hard to secure, but hard to argue against. So I guess you'd say that one of the major differences between the political parties, and they still do better mobilising opinion than the left and right in most of the rest of the democratic world. So I'm not a big knocker of the Australian system. I think we've got our problems and we've got to deal with those problems. And they can get worse, but I don't think we're too bad compared to others. And part of that is systemic. It's the character of our system which produces that. And it's important that it do so. So I think that while it's getting harder, I think we have better control mechanisms than anyone else. Now, I just got an invitation the other day. They wanted me, old friends wanted me to go up to Harvard. I can't do it, the restrictions that my job imposes, and lecture them on the subject of preferential and compulsory voting.
Right.
And what had they noticed? Well, what they noticed was this, that while our society is seeing a drift away from the major parties, and the emergence, particularly in the PR section, proportional representation sections of the parliament, of alternative political forces, the preferential system brings them back together again. In the end, the preferential system conglomerates votes, and it conglomerates votes to the largest section in it. And the largest sections in it happen to be the Labor Party, the Liberal Party, and the National Party. So in the end, votes get conglomerated under those headlines, no matter what people might think. Then compulsory, which I always used to say to the Americans, we don't have compulsory voting in Australia. We have compulsory attendance at the polls. And they can have less objection to compulsory attendance at the polls than they have to compulsory voting. And these people, these friends of mine, but they're, you know, academically powerfully engaged, see the Australian system as the answer to the American problem. So, and you know, when you look at the European systems, when you look at the Brits now, you look at us, I think we're doing it a bit better than most. But none of the divisiveness in their systems is absent ours.
So let's then agree that that the system can deliver for us as long as we use it wisely as mature and sensible Australians. And we can overcome those undoubted very real policy challenges here at home. But the reality is that, as you've said, we can't take our future for granted. The world we now live in has changed unbelievably. And with, you know, your background and the time that you've had in America, you've got some very valuable insights, I think, here to share with us. For one thing, we've been able to take it for granted ever since 1778, that the superpower of the day was there for us.
Mm.
Can we still take that for granted?
More complicated. And we really don't know where Trump's America is going to end up. One place we know pretty clearly it's going to end up at is with a real challenge to the so-called liberal international order, rules-based order, put in place after World War II. So many institutions of that, from World Trade Organization, United Nations, to the sanctity of the global commons, all of that, is off the list of important Trump values in global politics. In global politics, his attitude is essentially transactional, essentially tolerant of force majeure, if it's seen as an American interest that it be deployed. And all of that leads to an atmospheric in which those who create facts on the ground get those facts effectively recognised, and that nobody necessarily has any rights they can't fight for. I don't know if the United States is going to end up like that four or five years from now. There's a lot of resistance to that attitude inside the American system. And I think Trump's a one-off. I don't actually think you'll see somebody emerge with his exceptional set of media skills and utter brass, narcissism and determination to say what he likes when he likes about whether or not there's any truth in it at all. It suits an interest that he's trying to pursue. I don't see anybody in American politics who can establish that with the saliency he has managed to do so. So whatever happens is that when he goes, it'll be different. Now, will it be what it was before? Well, it's combined with other factors in the global system, which is sort of driving things away from that level of intense commitment to that old international order. And they will remain even when Trump has gone. I still think that we can bet on the United States ourselves. And that if we can't bet on the United States, what we'll need to bet on, we probably can't afford. And we are in many ways the default ally in the Asia-Pacific region. So I think they stick with us. And I think part of the reason they stick with us is that we have one attribute which most countries don't have. We have always had a determination to defend ourselves. Now, that might sound an odd thing to say. Most countries don't defend themselves. Most countries rely on the attitude of strangers, as said in the play, or most of them, the kindness of strangers. Most rely on civilized discourse between states. Their armies essentially for ceremonial or internal order. Australians have never taken that view. We have always taken the view that if we have to have a big, powerful friend, we'll have it and we'll pay the price for keeping them. And part of the price of keeping them is that we be easy to defend. And so we utilise them not so much to interpose themselves between us and the enemy, but to ensure that we have the capacity to confront the enemy ourselves. As we've got wealthier and we've got larger, that has been a more plausible goal. But we started really to try it from day one. I mean, Alfred Deakin, determining that we would not simply be part of the British Far East Fleet, we'd have our own navy and so on. So from day one, we've been taking the view that while we'll have to have our alliances, we'll be self-reliant within them.
So two big issues there that I'd love to explore a bit more. Firstly, America itself. Australians look at it, commentators say, well, what does Trump mean? Is he the problem or the product of the problem? But you're painting the picture of an America where there's still a lot of ballast, there's still a lot of solid community strength, perhaps deriving from that sort of commitment to family, to family values, to religion, that's easily missed when we look at inner city riots or tensions between police and blacks or the Hollywood portrayal of an America that's lost its way. There's still real ballast there because that obviously plays out in where they go post-Trump.
Look, absolutely. I think the important thing to comprehend is when you look at the various groups that participate in the vote in the United States, there is actually no American majority. Mm. There are multiples of forces, some stronger than others. I always used to, at my table, point out to the Democrats how rapidly they were losing the so-called white middle class, we would say white working class, in this country. And that when you total together, if you start playing identity politics, and you're an African American or Hispanic American, you play identity politics, you constitute, in the case of African Americans, 9%, and the others 16%. US society, you add up to 25%, white working class is about 35%. So you play identity politics, you lose.
Yeah.
That's the thing that you most have to watch out for. You know, I guess the thing is, in the conservative forces in Australia and the Labor Party, generally speaking, our message has been universalist, and we've seen that as the way to go. Harder to keep that message in the United States, because in their presidential system, as opposed to the Westminster system, every person in Congress is his own government, and they operate as though they are their own government.
Mm.
And so it's a much more divided political entity anyway. Which
sometimes looks quasi-corrupt, as you see the trading.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. But you also find, too, with them, that they all have to manipulate this scenario in whatever the mix is in their particular district. So it's mutually reinforcing the divisive and components of that sort of identity. You know, the whole world would look very different if Hillary Clinton had won the last election. Now, why didn't Hillary win it? There are many, many factors involved in that, and there's no single answer. But the key stat, which I keep telling people, is this. You take her firewall states of Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin. The Democratic firewall was the Republicans will never win these in a presidential election. Therefore, the Republicans will never win a presidential election from now on. Trump won them all. When you go into those states, which he only just lost by, Barack Obama had got 45% of the white working class in those three states. She got 35. If she got 40, she'd now be president. So she could actually take a dip in that support, but not the dip that she actually took. Now, how she got there, there's so many other, the Russians are involved, Comey's involved, all sorts of people are involved in getting there. But the fact that she got to that point meant that little blip, instead of just dropping to 40, but dropping to 35, meant in those states she fell over by a total of about 70,000 votes in millions, and she was gone. So the US is a close-run thing, and all these factors are engaged. What is terrifying the Republicans at this election is white, educated women. In many ways, the base of the old Republican vote, not the new people that Trump has brought on, is white, suburban women. And they are making amply clear they do not like Mr. Trump's behaviour. And they're very smart. So when their congressmen come to them, because they are mainly congressmen as opposed to congresswomen, come to them and say, now listen, you know what good liberal souls that we really are, or centrist souls and moderate souls that we are. We're not in with any of this. They say, oh, yes, you are. I haven't noticed any of you standing up to this fellow when he's been doing the various things that he has been doing. And while Trump got a majority of these women in the last election, he's probably down to the mid-20s among them now. And that translating across to the Republican Party, these are big turners out, these women. These are the women who organise everything. And they have turned against the Republican Party. Now they've got a couple of months to make it up. Weeks a long time in politics. A couple of months is a generation. But they're the ones who are going to, last time it was the white working class. This time, it is the white matriarchy who are going to determine the outcome.
The world, though, has changed enormously. Mm. You're a former defence minister. You've always been very strong on Australia standing up for its interests.
Mm.
What should we be doing now on that defence front?
Look, I think that there are many fine things in the Defence White Paper of 2016, and I said so at the time. But there's also based on certain assumptions which no longer apply. One of those was that we had an active ally in the rules-based order defence, and we do not have that ally anymore, not in the way in which we envisaged it then. And we determined that playing a part in that was to be a major determinant of the way we did our force structure. Well, what we have to do is to go back to basics here. That all those things are important, and we ought to do what we can with them, and we particularly ought to do it in the South Pacific, where nobody else will. It's just us who are prepared to play that sort of role in the South Pacific. And the Southeast Asians need people prepared to stand up behind them, and we do that too. We're very courageous, very forward-leaning, and very valuable, and we have to perform all those roles. But the starting point really now is being able to defend ourselves and our approaches. That's got to get priority. Priority two is to be reflective of our weaknesses and to deal with those weaknesses. I would identify one in big time that nobody will talk about, and that is we have no fuel reserves.
Couldn't agree with you more.
The International Energy Agency demands that we have 90 days reserves. We don't have anything remotely, I think it's 17, and less in specialist fuels. That is not possible.
Well, they can't fuel that's on ships coming towards us.
And they
themselves could be highly vulnerable if something goes wrong.
Totally vulnerable, absolutely totally vulnerable. The solution is storage and refining, which has largely disappeared. The amount that it would cost to build the storage and refining that we need is about $2 billion. If for 4 years you put an extra 2 cents a litre on the petrol excise, you get it. Now, will people in politics have the courage to stand up and say that? I'm not sure they will, but if we don't, that will remain a vulnerability. I used to argue we had a big vulnerability in categories of missiles. Actually, our engagement in Syria and Iraq has actually solved the problem. The Americans have loaded a bunch of missiles onto it, and we now have quite a bit of capacity in that area. We have the forward projection of getting the kit that we need, particularly submarines, is too far forward. And there'll be a chance to review all that when the three-year study that's going on in the French submarine comes in. And we ought to take full advantage of that, I think, to review progress on where we want to be with that. But we also, I think, have to consider what we are spending. Back in the day, in the 80s, we spent about 2.3% of GDP. If we spent that now, and had been spending that for the last, say, 10, 15 years, the defence budget would be $5 billion a year higher. And we would really not be talking about many problems at all when it came to talking about Australian defence. However, should we decide that the United States will play no part in this, should we eschew the weapon systems that we get from them, which make our defence workable? We can't work it without the renovations we get from American inventiveness and American intelligence. And you decide to go it alone, you have to do it with a nuclear weapon. And were we to get into, and people have to say that outright, that's their alternative. If we're going to defend ourselves, we might choose not to defend ourselves, we might choose to become like everybody else and see how long we last. Not long, I don't think, maybe another 30 or 40 years, but not long. And if you don't do it with how we do it now, then you've got to have a serious debate on nukes. You have a serious debate on nukes and you're talking about a cost of defence that's 4 or 5% of GDP. We cannot sustain that. We've got to educate our kids. We've got to sustain our health. We've got to ensure that we have the infrastructure that this nation needs. None of this is helpful. This sort of spending is helpful for any of those, on any of those fronts, except perhaps employment. And so you don't want to have to spend huge amounts of money on defence. You have to spend adequately on defence. Now, we've got the framework where we can do that, but we just have to do a few things differently.
Well, to take a simple, your starting point, the fuel, to not do that if something goes wrong, what will be said about today's generation of politicians by those who lose their freedom would be unprintable.
You know, I am always amazed by this. I had to do some unconscionable things in the United States, which I won't go into detail about trying to convince them we were serious on this front because we were about to be expelled from the IEA. So I did an awful lot of bull dusting, I have to say, to try and demonstrate that the argument, the propositions that you put up then about fuel at sea somehow constituted a realistic response, which it was not, and they knew it, but they liked me, so they, you know, would look at me sideways and say, well, generally speaking, you don't try to bull dust us, so I guess we give you a mulligan on one. But that is relatively easily resolvable, and everybody's got an interest in it. You know, you get something disruptive on the high seas, you get a diesel crisis. We've had diesel crises, these sorts of things.
Yeah, yeah.
Where we've got to, you know, that affects us all when this sort of thing
transpires. The east coast of New South Wales went within a couple of days of running out of diesel at the last major flood event in Queensland.
Yeah.
And it was the middle of harvest. I'm a farmer.
Yeah.
The dislocation and the disruption, the economic wailing would have been probably enough to bring a government down.
Yeah.
And years on, we've done nothing about it.
Yeah.
Neither side's taken it seriously.
Oh, that's right. Neither side has.
It's just extraordinary to me.
Mm.
So you mentioned the other thing there, lead times. I think it was essentially, as long ago as 2008 or 9, white paper, broadly based decision that we needed to move to 12 upgraded submarines. Forget about all the arguments of what they should have been, where they should have come from. The fact that we're now still at a point 10 years after that, where final decisions have not been made, contracts have not been signed, and we'll be lucky to get the first one by 2035, it smacks of a complacency that, again, I just wonder what our kids will say about us if something goes wrong.
Look, I used to say when I was Defence Minister, and we said, you know, we have short-term threats that we have to be able to deal with immediately. We've got more challenging threats that one can foresee that we have to be able to deal with probably immediately too. And then we have the long-term existential threat, which we have to keep capability to handle and the rest of it. Those clear-cut divisions don't really apply anymore. We're in a much more serious situation than we were then. But I think that, and I think that when it comes to submarines, that's one place where I'd put the question mark over our performance. But you also need to look at where the glass is half full. I used to have this feeling that, what if I'm wrong in all those calculations we've made about short and long-term threats? Can we, from a standing start, defend ourselves? In my day, you could say, no. The answer was no. Today it's yes, for one reason. That's the Air Force. The Australian Air Force now is magnificent. And when you look at the combination that we have of what we can access from the American satellite systems, which we are engaged with, and we now have as much access as the Americans do to their product. They're really genuinely joint facilities now. Then you add it to our over-the-horizon radar, which is largely an Australian invention, though it started with a substantial American input, the best in the world. When you add to that the performance of our early warning aircraft, which have been tested thoroughly now in the Middle East, and doing a magnificent job, and they're better than America.
It was a very close run thing to purchase those.
Yes, I know. You'd be happy with that.
I'm very happy with it.
They're very
because
good.
Because it worked out.
That's right.
And we bought more.
You did.
We increased the order.
They're great.
And a force multiplier.
That's right. Big one. And then you add to that that our classic Hornets are supported by Growlers and by Super Hornets. I was critical of Brendan Nelson when he picked up on the Super Hornet, but he was right. It's a very good aircraft. Coming in with the F-35s, coming off the line now, I think we own about half a dozen of them. This is a fifth generation air defence capability, and very few countries have it. And in our region, it is decisive against all comers, and I mean all comers. And it's not enough, but you know, as a defence minister who was always worried by that night time, 3 o'clock in the morning, I wake up with anxiety often 3 o'clock in the morning, and you will, oh God, what if I'm wrong? You know, if you're the defence minister, you're making those calculations, what if I'm wrong? Am I going to lose my country? And I think the current defence minister, Christopher Pyne, can wake up and say he probably won't, courtesy of those attributes.
The JSF, just before we leave it, Bit of controversy around them?
Oh, a stack of controversy, but always is. Mm. You know,
think back to the days of the F-111 when they first
introduced
it. Yeah,
exactly. The F-111 is the classic case in point, and it had many flaws. So, you know, there are many flaws in these projects which are technologically at the cutting edge. They're never going to work perfectly, certainly not to start off with. They're going to take ages to get into the shape that you'd want them in. The great thing about the F-35 is that if your opponents decide to attack the enablers, the early warning aircraft we were talking about, if they decide to attack them, and they could ostensibly force you a long way back if they can do that credibly, with the F-35 it doesn't matter. The F-35 is its own AWACS, and it's also an AWACS for everybody else. So a couple of F-35s can not only vector their own attack, they can vector the Super Hornets and the Growlers. And so you've got an awful lot of redundancy in the system with the F-35s coming in. People say they can't dogfight. Well, no, they're not dogfighters, they're eliminators. And they're not fighters, they're a platform, a sensor platform. Yeah. And they finally exercised them, boringly, you know, I think it was Red Flag or one of the last ones that the Americans did. And they gave them their attributes. So they were flown by the trainee pilots, and the Red Forces were flown by the experienced fighter pilots who came after them. They lost 18-1. Somebody turned his systems down poorly on the F-35 and they lost it. All of them were shot down by the F-35 before they even, you know, the umpire just rang them and said, "You're gone." Yeah. "What? There's nothing here." "But you're gone."
Yeah.
And they say, that's the thing with them.
Yeah.
They have those attributes which are critical. That's why they're called fifth generation, and not fourth.
Excellent. You mentioned something there that I'd just like to pick up on. Mm-hmm. The responsibilities of high office, I think, are perhaps dismissed a little too lightly by people who haven't been there.
Mm.
I didn't live with that sort of constant concern as a defence minister, but I was acting PM when 9/11 happened.
Mm.
You do feel the weight of the country on you. I remember thinking to myself, what happens, a buck stops with me? What happens if I miss some important bit of intelligence? Because we assume there might be follow-ons. It's a horrible feeling.
Mm.
And I think, why do I mention it? It's probably a plea to our fellow Australians to recognise that we do ask a lot of our elected leaders. We shouldn't be cynical all the time. We do need some trust.
Mm.
And there are men and women who do step up. And we don't want that to change because we make it so unattractive that good and capable and honourable people think it's just not worth even trying.
Look, I think that's absolutely right. And, you know, in politics, as you know, you live on psychic capital, no other form of capital, not unless you're completely corrupt.
Yeah.
And in Australia, you don't get away with corruption.
No.
You do.
Certainly
in some
at federal
places.
Level.
Certainly not at the federal level. No, you don't get away with corruption.
Mm.
You don't actually try. You know, you don't see much intentional corruption emerging at any.
Well, Bob Hawke used to make that point. I think he was right.
Yeah, I mean, we don't actually at the federal level have responsibility for planning, and planning is the most easily corruptible area of political life, frankly, and that's all in the hands of state and local government, not federal.
Mm. So that honeypot that Bob Hawke called it, it's not there.
Yeah, that's right. There isn't that much there. But I think also it is the case that you will often face, if not an existential threat of a kinetic character, you'll often face it of a financial character.
Mm.
That'll happen every few years, no matter whether you like it or not.
Yeah.
And then you have the agonising of having to go out and look at all the people losing work, looking at the impact that you're having on the families, the people of your country.
Yeah.
And you agonise about that. You agonise. I know people in all political parties agonise about that all the time.
Yeah.
Nobody really goes out consciously to hurt anybody. But sometimes what you do or what you have forced on you does hurt people. And you have to live with it and fight to redress it. But it's no easy life for anyone in politics. And one of the problems is we make it so hard for each other. We make it so hard when it comes to discussing pay or retirement benefits or, you know, the various peccadilloes, the way in which you use your allowances, all of that sort of thing. We constantly demean ourselves in political life, and we wonder why other people join in.
Yeah. Well, you continue your noble commitment to public service. You're now the Governor of Western Australia. Susie by your side. Are you enjoying it?
I'm finding it worthwhile. The one thing the Premier said to me, which attracted me to the job, he said, look, I think West Australia could do with a bit of an advocate. And so that's not necessarily a gubernatorial role. A gubernatorial role, quintessentially, in the first instance, is constitutional. That's the things I must do on behalf of the Queen in the political system that operates here. I reckon that's about 6 hours' work a week. Then there is what you might call the encouragement function. The fact that many people look upon you to provide patronage and encouragement and to appear to verify the things that they're doing in the community or with each other. And every conceivable form of community organisation expects that of you. And you do that. And it is enjoyable. It's like being a member of parliament again. You know, when you're first elected, you go around all the social units in your community. You know, the people who do the housing, the people who do the street folk, the people who are doing the health provision, the people doing the employment service. You go around all of them in your community. Well, I now go around all of them. Only then I dealt with the community level, the state level, the local level operation. I now deal with the state level operation as the thing that focuses on me. I love being I'm the chief scout, for example, and of Western Australia. So you have all of that, and it's important that all of that gets done. And that's it usually. But what the state government here has asked me to do, and do advocacy. So, you know, we've got tourism industry things here that we need to think through. We've got next phase industrial development. You've got the minerals, you've got the character of us as a state, as a defence entity within the Commonwealth. Do advocacy on those fronts. That's what's attractive about it.
You've been listening to Conversations with John Anderson. For further content, visit johnanderson.net.au.